Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 7th of March, 2012 for me here in Japan. It's still the 6th of March, 2012 back in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Dr. Bruce E. Levine. Dr. Levine is a practicing clinical psychologist and also an author of numerous books, including Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. He's contributed to a number of online periodicals, Counterpunch, Alternate, Truthout, Z-Mag, The Huffington Post. His articles have appeared in many other places besides. He's also on the editorial advisory board of the journal Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry, and has many other accolades to his credit. So, Dr. Levine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Great to be on your show.
All right. Well, obviously, I just gave the sort of bullet point bio for you, but perhaps you can expand that out a little and tell us a little bit more about your background and where it is you're coming from.
Sure. I'm a clinical psychologist here in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I've been in practice for almost 28 years. And I really was, for a long time, just kind of in practice and not really a very public person, not writing books or articles. But several years ago, my profession, the mental health profession, just became increasingly embarrassing. I mean, there were always problematic things about the mental health profession, but at some point, they snapped and became, totally sort of bought off by the drug companies, almost annexed by pharmaceutical companies. And also, too, there became increasing incentives to create more and more pathology, more and more diagnosing of perfectly normal behavior. And I saw this way back when I was in graduate school. There is the Diagnostic Bible for mental health professionals is something called a DSM. And we're up to the DSM-4, and each one of these ones gets larger and larger, more and more diagnoses. But at this point in graduate school, it was 1980, and they had come out with the DSM-3. And they finally got rid of one diagnosis that year. They almost never get rid of ones, but homosexuality used to be a mental illness, and gay folks didn't like being called mentally ill, so they protested, and they actually frightened the American Psychiatric Association, who publishes this manual, and they eliminated that. But that's rare that a diagnosis ever gets kicked out. And as they kicked out homosexuality from the DSM, they added, the American Psychiatric Association added many, many more diagnoses, and picked on groups of people that had a harder time defending themselves, most notably children and teenagers. And so that year there was a slew of these childhood diagnoses that got added. And one of the ones that I remember being in school, I said, boy, I'm already a little embarrassed by my profession. Now you guys are really embarrassed me. They added something called ODD, Oppositional Defiant Disorder, which has been increasingly popular. And this so-called disease, really, the symptoms of it are often argue with adults, often refuse to comply with adults. And as I looked at it, I said, you guys got to be kidding. If you go through symptoms of these, almost every significant political activist, artist, on and on, would have been diagnosed as. And also, there are a lot of other diagnoses that are more sort of subtly rebellious. So, for example, the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder diagnosis, it actually first started out as attention deficit disorder. What we know from the research is that most of these kids can pay attention when they're actually interested in something, when they've chosen it, when, in fact, if you pay them, they'll pay attention to it. And it's really one of they just are more non-compliant. They don't pay attention to things that they don't care about, which certainly can create a handful for many teachers who are trying to control a classroom. I mean, I understand the plight of many teachers who have these kids, but to say that they're diseased and disordered because they only pay attention, they won't comply and they won't pay attention when they're bored and uninterested like some other more compliant and conformist kids, well, this also seemed problematic. But that was a little more subtle than oppositional defiant disorder, which seemed outrageous to call that a disease, as opposed to this was a stubborn kid who was not easily compliant, and we've always had kids like that, and we didn't disease them. And so I started to think way back then about how this profession was increasingly kind of pathologizing people who were stubborn, non-compliant. And then as I've moved into my practice over the last 28 years, I saw that it just wasn't these kids. That as I got to know a lot of people who were diagnosed with anxiety disorder, who were diagnosed with depression, and many, many substance abuse folks, many people I've even met who had one time in their life been diagnosed with a psychosis, schizophrenia, it was amazing for me how many of these folks, if you really got to know them, were more essentially anti-authoritarian. and how many of the people who had diagnosed them were really more authoritarian. And I guess I should define that. I mean, authoritarian just simply means people who don't question authority. And anti-authoritarians, they question whether an authority is legitimate or not legitimate, whether that authority, whether that authority is honest, whether they know what they're talking about. And if that authority isn't legitimate, then they challenge and they resist. And so there have always been anti-authoritarians and there are always authoritarians. And it was really interesting for me that many of the people that my profession was pathologizing, psychopathologizing, calling mentally ill, were more essentially anti-authoritarians. And many of the mental health professionals were more essentially authoritarians.
Well, that's right. And you bring up the issue of the Diagnostic Bible, the DSM, now 4, going on for 5. And I understand DSM-5 is in the development stage right now. And of course, that brings up the entire question of the institutionalization of diagnoses of psychiatric disorders and how the American Psychiatric Association, I mean, whether or not it is completely beholden to the manufacturers of the pharmaceuticals that claim to be able to treat some of these disorders, certainly the suggestion that there is any type of connection there brings with it the possibility that the DSM is really shaped with that in mind, with the idea of selling drugs to medicate people in mind. And it brings with it a number of troubling issues. And as I understand, the DSM-5 now is starting to look at a whole range of new possible diagnoses that that may come along that I'm sure the drug manufacturers will be right along behind with some new drugs to take care of.
Right. I mean, on the one easy level, I mean, the American Psychiatric Association is funded to some degree by drug companies. But even if they were not, they have they're both in a strictly kind of, if you take a look at analysis, just follow the money trail or a strictly financial analysis, which unfortunately a lot of life can be explained that way, is that the more that certainly these drug companies, the more of normal human behavior can be viewed as pathology, mental illness, there's more potential for them to sell drugs, and the more that people, instead of a few percentage of people who are viewed as having mental difficulties, you could jack it up to 20-30%. There's more business for psychiatrists. So they both, even if the American Psychiatric Association and many psychiatrists were not working, getting paid for directly by drug companies, which is the case, that there would be they have mutual goals there, and I think that's a troubling thing, and so. The thing that I think a lot of American psychiatrists, they would just be appalled and aghast by what I'm saying, because for them, they could probably pass a lie detector test saying that these kids who these oppositionally defiant disorder kids, or let's take another whole area, these social anxiety, these are just shy kids who about 20 years ago, that the makers of Paxil, this GlaxoSmithKline, they actually hired public relations people to not so much spread Paxil, but because they're already making a few billion dollars a year for using Paxil as an antidepressant, but they thought, well, we can make more if we also use it for an anti-anxiety, but we have to kind of convince people out there that this social anxiety is, in fact, a disease that should be medicated, and they went ahead and they did that, used the public relations people, and now they've got more and more parents out there convinced that they're shy kids out there, they have some mental illness, and they too need to be medicated. And so, but I bet a lot of these psychiatrists, if they looked at a lot of these kids, for them, kids who were not fitting in, kids who were not adapting, kids who were not adjusting, adults who were depressed by how crappy life is. I mean, these folks do look diseased and disordered to people who are essentially much more compliant than conformist. So if you have in your head that you're going to comply to any authority, no matter how illegitimate authority is, to get ahead, you don't care if the teacher's a complete idiot, that you have no respect for him, that, the teacher's a bozo that reminds you of whatever, Newt Gingrich and Donald Trump combined or whatever, it's your job to follow orders and to comply. And you see folks out there who don't do that as something wrong with them, because how could they, if you're doing it and they're not doing it, there's have to be something wrong with them. And you call that mental illness. And that's really what happens much more than these folks, I think, sinisterly, corruptly, deviously of labeling folks that they know are, that they know there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, I think these people actually do have a very, very narrow range of what they believe is normal behavior.
Well, I imagine that's something that will resonate strongly with the listeners of this podcast, because obviously I think the audience for this podcast tends to be defiantly anti-authoritarian in a number of ways. And I thought this issue was raised very interestingly in an article that you recently published on Alternet called "Would We Have Drugged Up Einstein? How Anti-Authoritarianism is Deemed a Mental Health Problem." And it brings it down to a level that I think most people will be able to relate to easily. So perhaps we can talk a little bit about the main point of this and about Albert Einstein himself.
Well, certainly Einstein would have been for sure labeled with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder if he was going to an American school system here today and seeing American psychiatrists, and probably maybe even oppositional defiant disorder as well. I mean, we know that, you know, he just didn't bother paying attention to his teachers. Why? Well, it wasn't he had ADHD. I mean, they were boring for him. I mean, he was, as a young guy, he was looking out the window thinking about light. I mean, it was a lot more interesting for him thinking about what does light consist of, waves or particles or whatever, than it was to whatever some teacher was. But he didn't bother paying attention. He also failed his college entrance examination twice. He didn't bother, had a hard time holding jobs. Why? Because they were boring. And why did he fire? You know, he had no real, he was, you know, his father wanted him to have some very practical job, just like a lot of, you know, parents do. They want their kids to have a practical thing. And Einstein was appalled by that. So that's why he purposely flunked these things. He talked about, there's a quote from Einstein that he said, the teachers in my elementary school, he reminded them of sergeants, you know, and he saw them as very militaristic, and he just rebelled. And, he's infamous, Einstein, for rebelling against all folks. And, you know, he was correct about lots of illegitimate authorities, especially in the world of science and in many other areas, actually politically as well. He would rebel against a lot of people, especially when he became famous. And so these were the things that made him so endearing. Was Einstein perfect? No. I mean, there was a lot of things that he was a pain in the butt, I mean, with, in terms of not being able to get along real well and, you know, in family. And he was a pretty lousy husband, pretty lousy father. I'm not going to romanticize Einstein, but he was an anti-authoritarian that found out this, you know, was the great anti-authoritarian of the 20th century in terms of scientific truths. And if psychiatry, you know, I'm sure there's some young Einstein walking around today in our schools. He's depending on what kind of parents he has, there's a good chance he's going to get himself medicated.
Well, very sobering assessment, but unfortunately one that seems to ring true with the state that our society is in right now. And of course, the opposite side of the anti-authoritarianism that you mentioned is authoritarianism, the idea that there are people out there who are conformist, who are compliant, who go along with the system, who respect power and never question it. And I think that obviously this is a state of affairs that applies to certain of the psychologists and psychiatrists who actually practice in the profession. And some, I think, are more than willing to take advantage of that mindset for their own purposes. And in that regard, I'm sure many of my listeners will be familiar with the stories of people like B.F. Skinner, who was practicing, obviously, behaviorism and developing that theory and the operant conditioning and taking that to the next level and things like that, which seems to be, unfortunately, the way that the psychiatric and psychological professions have been moving for a long time in terms of trying to make people more compliant instead of less. Perhaps you can flesh out some of that history and some of the
I was mentioning, funny you mentioned B.F. Skinner, but when I was an undergraduate, I mean, he was probably the most famous psychologist in America. He had written one of the most famous books that got even on bestseller list was something with a title called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And I remember, again, being 18, 19 years old in college, and I'm saying, you got to be kidding. I mean, you people are taking seriously an author who's making fun of freedom and dignity? And in fact, he was. For him, everything, these were just illusions. They were delusions. I mean, they were, you know, people were all controlled. You know, they were... You can manipulate, modify, and control, you know, anyone. And this was standard in psychology for many years. I remember the first time I worked in an ward in a hospital, in a back ward. I mean, they were all these people. They wanted me to reward guys twice my age with cigarettes, by the way. They were using those as tokens, these things called token economies that they would, you know, use to reward folks for acting the way they wanted to. And I remember just looking at them. I said, you got to be kidding. You expect me this, you know, to reward a guy twice my age just for sort of hanging out and having a conversation with me because you think that that's good for him, and you want me to, don't you see how humiliating, how undignified and insulting that was? And the funny thing for me was the people who were, you know, labeled, you know, seriously mentally ill, they understood exactly what I was talking about. And, you know, they realized that, and they just would roll their eyes, and deep down inside, they knew, like, you know, they may be acting crazy and sort of scary, but at some level, they had more sense of, like, humanity, you know, than a lot of these mental health professionals who were in charge. And I always became sort of concerned whether they were pull-pushing psychiatrists or behavior-modifying psychologists or whatever, that these folks just had a strong sort of need to just have people comply and control. And the scary thing was that they had a population that was most vulnerable. So, for example, you know, when family members, especially parents, sees their child, whether they're 5 years old or 15-year-old, acting in a little bit of a strange way, acting in a bizarre way, or just not paying attention nowadays, but way back then, that wouldn't have been, you know, if somebody was, you know, they were acting a little strange, and they would be scared. And they're much more, when you're scared, no matter how smart you are, no matter how bright you are, you're vulnerable to authorities acting and sounding like they know what they're talking about. And as I went through my training as a psychologist, I realized most of the training was about getting people to look like they sounded like they knew what they were talking about, not to really know what they were talking about. So you had a lot of people learning the craft of self-assuredness and certainty and being, you know, like looking like they knew what they were talking about, but they really had no idea what the hell they were talking about. I mean, there was nothing scientific at all about the whole diagnostic process. We know that from lots of studies. You know, the same person could go into, you know, five different psychiatrists and get five different diagnoses. It's completely unreliable, these diagnoses. There's no, you know, blood test or lab test or anything like that, and so it's all based on subjective views. And you know, somebody's going to walk in my office, and I won't view them as mentally ill. And I kind of like them; they seem like a neat anti-authoritarian. They're going to walk into somebody else's office, and they're going to get slapped with all kinds of heavy mental illnesses. It happens all the time. And all of their stuff about biochemical brain imbalances, you know, this ultimately has as much legitimacy as validity as the weapons of mass destruction pretext for getting us into Iraq in that war. I mean, there was just absolute scientific pseudoscience. And ultimately, if you follow the whole history of my profession, is they come out with something, a scientific theory, and sells a whole bunch of drugs. And then when it's disproven, they just go, oops, well, we're moving on. We're making progress. Well, they're not making any progress at all. It's just they were completely wrong, and they don't know really what the hell they're talking about.
Well, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, the history of people like B.F. Skinner looms large in the history of psychology, and those types of names are very well known. But what about the other, I mean, there certainly must be other people who have been working before you and who have come, who have been part of the history of developing an anti-authoritarian type of mindset among psychologists. I mean, who are some of the other people that we could or should be studying rather than devoting our attention to people like Skinner?
Well, I think it's interesting. There's a thread from both the left and the libertarian world that I talk a lot about both Eric Fromm, who is a left, sort of democratic socialist anti-authoritarian, but he had very similar views as about this issue of control. As did Thomas Sass, that's S-Z-A-S-Z, who, and both of these folks, I should tell you, when I was an undergraduate in the 1970s, they were taught in introductory psychology. They were respected figures. They might not have been, you know, they might not have been the people that were in majority view, but they were given a lot of ink, and people took what they were saying seriously. And people like Eric Fromm would talk a lot about being afraid that psychology, psychiatry, and psychoanalysis was increasingly become the tool in the manipulation of men. That's almost an exact quote from Eric Fromm. And he would talk a lot about worrying about what are people, the profession, helping people adapt and adjust, but to what? And so, you know, what Fromm was much more, you know, concerned about was he wrote books called, like, The Sane Society, which is really about an insane society. And his concern was that psychologists, and this has gotten worse even in my day, don't have any kind of, there's no critical thinking about how sane or insane your society is, and you're just trying to help people adapt and adjust. to anything. And already for him, he saw this in the 1950s when he wrote that book, that the society had gotten pretty insane, pretty dehumanizing. People were becoming more conformist, compliant, more automaton. And he was going like, what is my profession doing? Just helping people adapt and adjust to an increasingly insane society. And Thomas Sasse was also very much concerned about how these uses of mental illnesses were in some ways disempowering people. It was like having people, you know, abdicate responsibility for all their actions, and you know, being used in the court system and all kinds of ways that were that may feel like for some people that they were being able to kind of get away without being responsible for their behavior, but ultimately was doing them a disservice. So there's a whole school of folks, you know, in the kind of Thomas Sasse world, we'll talk about, you know, something. There's a quote, this is not by Sasse, but a quote by C.S. Lewis that goes, of all tyrannies, you know, the ones that are most oppressive are that are done for people with the idea of their own good. And so, you know, it's the interesting thing for me that you'll see a kind of, just like in our political world, you know, there's this, people have this divide between left and right. But if you take a look at, say, people like Ralph Nader and Ron Paul, there's disagreement on some fundamental issues like healthcare, but there's a lot of agreement on terms of illegitimate authorities out there getting us into senseless wars and crazy Wall Street bailouts. And you'll see the same thing at the political level in critics of the few anti-authoritarians who are in criticizing the whole mental health professionals. There's some folks who are more kind of connected with the left and some folks connected more with the libertarian. But on the fundamental view of that psychiatry is just a pretty much an illegitimate authority that's kind of pushing people around, you know, that's a shared view.
Absolutely right. And that's a point that that I make on this podcast frequently, is that the left and right is really more of a type of mental control over the political process rather than something that's indicative of an actual on the ground political reality. And I think that the real issue is one between statism and centralization of control versus freedom of the individual. And I definitely understand the point that people like Nader and Paul have much more in common than I guess they would with someone like Obama and or pick your choice, sure, Santorum or whoever. So I think that's something that's important to keep in mind when we take a look at this. But on the note of anti-authoritarianism, then I guess there's obviously a range of different thought on the subject. But something that I've come to time and again, and that I want to continue to explore, is the idea of how people can really overcome and transcend the hopelessness and the helplessness that people feel as being part of trapped in the system, because that's obviously a key way that people are brought to the point of what has been termed learned helplessness. So I'd like to get your take on that term itself, on Seligman's experiments and what it might indicate for a way out of this.
Sure. I mean, the learned helplessness, you know, our profession is good at a couple, the psychology profession is good at sometimes just turning common sense into, like, you know, fancy experiments and studies. But in this case of learned helplessness, it's certainly not bad what we did. I mean, here's the famous studies that happened in the late 70s is what they did. There's a lot of different kinds of studies, but one of the most famous ones is they had a couple of groups of dogs, and one group of dogs, these groups both got equal amount of electroshocks. I mean, you can never do these studies today because of ethics and animal rights, but what they were able to pull these things off in the 70s, these groups got equal amount of electroshocks, but the difference was in one group of dogs, the first group, they had control over stopping their electroshocks, so they could press their nose on a panel and stop the shock, whereas the second group of dogs, they had no control. I mean, the shocks would stop, you know, eventually, but it would just be nothing that they did that stopped it. The experiment that would stop it. And so then they looked at these groups of dogs, and the dogs that had no control, they were deemed the kind of learned helpless dogs, and they looked passive and depressed. And then they put both of these groups of dogs in another task where all they really had to do, they were again being shocked in one box, and all they had to do to escape their shock was to explore a little and discover if they just hopped over a short barrier, then they would be able to move into another place where they weren't getting shocked. And so the dogs who had learned earlier, the first group that had learned that they had some control over stopping their shocks, they did the exploring and they escaped the shock, whereas the second group that had, you know, learned that no matter what they did, they really had no control, they did not even bother trying to explore and escape. And so, you know, that is one of the principles for me. There's lots of what in the Get Up Stand Up, the book that you referred to earlier, one of the things that I do in that book is talk about all the reasons that the whole American public has gotten pacified, and they go through a lot of different aspects of our culture and different institutions, but some of the psychological principles is this learned helplessness, and it's really scary because it happens in so many areas of our life, including the one area that most people put all their democracy eggs into, which is our electoral politics. You know, if you have a real democracy, you don't have learned helplessness. But to show that we don't have a real democracy is that we do have learned helplessness. How does that happen? Well, in the key issues, like, you know, one of, like, for example, senseless wars and corporate control and all that, no matter what you do, you vote for a Democrat, you vote for a Republican, you're still going to get senseless wars, and you're going to get corporate control, and you're going to get Patriot Acts, and you're going to get all kinds of things. I mean, there's some differences between these folks. I'm not saying there's completely no difference between these Republicans and Democrats, but in things that really are painful for people, they cannot stop the pain. You know, if they stay home and don't vote at all, which is what a lot of people do, and I understand that, you know, that doesn't stop the pain. You're still going to get senseless wars and corporate control. You vote for some third party. Well, third parties don't have any chance in America. Nader, Paul, these kinds of, they're not going to happen. It's money controls everything. And so people move into a learned helplessness. So that's one of the principles for me that how you get people to move into helplessness. There's some other psychological principles as well.
By all means, can you
One of the other things that I talk about is I've worked a lot with anybody who's been a psychologist or mental health professional for a bunch of years has had to have worked a lot with the people who've been abused. And you can be physically abused, you can be sexually, emotionally, you can be abused by your spouse, your boss, you know, all kinds of stuff. And basically, is the fundamental thing of abuse is like you're being treated with no respect. That somebody treats you like you're just an object, like you don't matter. And if you accept that early on, if you don't walk away, you don't extricate, you know, from the first time, you know, you get beat emotionally or somebody rips you off or, you know, whatever. And if you accept that, you get weaker. You lose some self-respect, you lose some strength, and then it's easier for whoever it is, the pimp, the abuser, abusive spouse, or the boss or whatever, to keep, you know, pouring it on, and you just get weaker and weaker, and it's a kind of downward vicious cycle. And I think, you know, that's another dynamic that's happened here in America. I mean, you know, you saw that for me. I really saw that. One of the reasons I started to write that Get Up Stand Up was after the 2008 Wall Street bailout, where I'm going like, are you guys kidding me? You guys are going to be able to pull this thing off where you just basically, I mean, this is something, again, across the political spectrum, left, right, whatever you want to call it, we're just in awe. You guys, all you people are telling me, from the Democrats, you're telling me that you actually, you know, were anti-corporate. Well, obviously you're not. And all you Republicans are telling me that you believe in the market economy and if companies fail, they should just go down. Well, you're obviously all lying. You're obviously all just in the pocket of these guys. There was another, I mean, I remember that moment at the end of 2008. It was, you know, a fall of 2008. It was just so obvious that who was in control and who was running the show. But people, and you just see people looking at each other, you know, but they were so beaten down, and they bought the fear that if they don't just bail out all these people, that there's going to be some kind of Armageddon is going to come here, and they just all let it happen. And that's exactly the kind of thing that you'll see in a kind of an abuse syndrome. And so one of the things that I talk about is corporatocracy abuse and battered people syndrome. And this corporatocracy is this term that I use that it just means very simply this combination, this ruling partnership between these, you know, huge, too big to fail so-called corporations, these ridiculously wealthy elite, and their governmental collaborators, their politicians. They all work together, and I use that word again to kind of unify anti-authoritarians across the political spectrum, instead of, you know, sitting around and going like, well, it's the government who's ruining our lives, and the left, you know, picks on, you know, the giant corporations. I'm going like, hey, these guys work together, don't you get it? And then, you know, some people come along and they say, well, Bruce, why are you using that term? That you know that's fascism. And I go like, well, I'm not going to argue here. Fascism is this integration between government and industry, but there's a little bit more that goes along along with fascism than that, but that's one aspect of it. But once you understand that, that this is happening, there's some possibility for unifying anti-authoritarian. So that's a lot of what I care about, is like, how do we energize and unify people who really are genuine populists who believe that it should be government of, by, and for the people, and how do we unify anti-authoritarians, of which I think there are a lot of them out there, but they've been so pacified, and we were talking earlier in the conversation about just only one way that they're, you know, one spoke in the wheel, how my mental health profession has been doing some pacifying, but there's a lot of other things happening besides that.
Unfortunately so, but I think you're exactly right to indicate that we do need to look for that unifying concept that transcends that left-right political mind barrier that a lot of people have. And I think you're right to locate it in corporatocracy. I recently had an episode of my radio broadcast on that very subject, and locating the nexus of power in the exact same way that you do. It's corporations and government working in unison, in lockstep, so that either the left or the right can attack one side of that, but it doesn't fundamentally attack the institution itself. But on the note of taking the power back and transcending that hopelessness, fighting back, you had a very another great article on Alternet back in September of last year, how anti-authoritarians can transcend their sense of hopelessness and fight back. And I'd just like to read a little bit from the section in that article called Critical Thinking About Critical Thinking, where you write, "The battle against the corporatocracy demands critical thinking, which results in seeing many ugly truths about reality. This critical thinking is absolutely necessary. Without it, one is more likely to engage in tactics that can make matters worse. Critical thinking also means the ability to think critically about one's pessimism, realizing that pessimism can cripple the will. Critical thinkers who reflect on their own critical thinking recognize how negativism can cause inaction, which results in maintaining the status quo," which I thought was a particularly revealing insight. Perhaps we can expand a little bit more on that and how critical thinking can be used as a tool to help understand and overcome our sense of helplessness.
Right. I mean, this is a problem, I think, for a lot of people who are depressives. You know, those are the groups that I initially were studying, were people who were like anti-authoritarians who were depressive, and they knew that a lot, they were just in some ways too smart for their own good. I mean, they knew that depressives, by the way, studies show that they're more astute in their understanding of how powerless they are in organizations or in other kind of situations. They've done studies on this. They're more astute in realizing and seeing how people really feel about them. And so a lot of what happens to a lot of people politically, a lot of anti-authoritarians, is they see very clearly, you know, how powerful these giant, say, for example, industrial complexes are, how powerful the military-industrial complex is. They see how difficult it really is going to be. They understand they're not naive about, you know, the electoral process. And so with all the truths that they see quite accurately in many cases, they can become overwhelmed by them. And that was one of the other reasons that I wrote the Get Up Stand Up, was that to have people who weren't completely beaten down yet and who were frustrated and exasperated that there weren't enough people, you know, active, to be able to understand why some people kind of give up, and to have much more, you know, understanding for that as opposed to contempt and disgust, because that's not going to, again, unify folks. And so one of the things that we need to have back in the fight are these kind of critically thinking anti-authoritarians, and we need to validate and, you know, give them, you know, total understanding for the fact of why they would give up, that they see, you know, whether, you know, a guy like me who understands the psychiatric pharmaceutical complex, or somebody who's in the military who understands that complex, the military-industrial complex, or the, you know, if you're working in the oil industry and you understand the whole energy-industrial complex, it's very easy, you know, to just look like, my God, these people have, you know, billions of dollars, and it takes so little to buy off these prostitute politicians. How are we ever going, you know, it's getting get worse with this Citizens United thing? And so you, there's a lot of reasons to kind of sink. And so part of what I wanted to do in my work there and those articles and in Get Up Stand Up was to say to critically thinking anti-authoritarians is that, number one, that your own critical thinking can, you know, be get you so pessimistic that it just kind of maintains the status quo, and that's exactly what those folks who are in control want. And also too, very rationally, if you take a look at human history, there's been many, many times where that critical thinker thinks that they see that there's absolutely no chance, and they're not seeing everything. So one of the examples that I give is is say Abraham Lincoln, who was probably of all our presidents the most critically thinking president, and he was also a major depressive, I should say. They sometimes go together. I mean, he actually had a couple times in his young life where he got suicidal. His friends had to have a suicide watch. A guy like him, you know, would never be elected president in America. Guys, you know, depressed critical thinkers don't get elected nowadays, thanks to my profession in a lot of ways, because we've created this stigma of being depressed. But back then, in the 1850s, 1860s, he was, you know, viewed more majestically, like, you know, yeah, the guy must really have some, you know, soul and wisdom, the fact that he got that depressed. But anyways, in the 1850s, Lincoln was looking at the whole slave issue, and this was a time when he really hadn't come out for, you know, abolition. He was more like just not wanting to spread slavery. This was the big battle in the America, in the United States in the 1850s, those forces who wanted to see the spread of slavery and those forces that were opposed to the spread of slavery. And Lincoln was clearly opposed to the spread of slavery, but he took a look at the whole thing. I have a quote in Get Up, Stand Up where he looks at this thing very analytically, very intellectually, and he just looks at it financially, and he says, look, we're going to lose. The South has so much more to gain than we have to gain, you know, and so much more to lose than we have to lose on this issue of slavery, and all we have is more of a kind of moral thing, and the morality is nice, but it's not gonna trump the kind of financial things. And he went through this, but what he couldn't imagine was, and this is, you know, just, you know, he couldn't imagine, number one, that he would ever get the Republican presidential nomination, and that, you know, that, but he would, that there would be three parties running, and he would be able to actually win because he would won with less than a majority of vote. He couldn't imagine that. He couldn't imagine that the South would secede off of that, because, and then even if that just had happened, that wouldn't have been enough. He couldn't imagine that some guys in South Carolina would be, you know, crazy enough to start firing at a federal fort, Fort Sumter, which was sort of like the 9/11 of that era, and that created the political will for the North to say, like, well, we're going to go in there and invade. Nobody in the North cared enough about slavery. Not nobody, I should say. They were the radical Republican abolitionists. A very, you know, small percentage of the North actually cared about slavery. But the idea that they were going to fire at one of our forts, well, that they cared about. You can imagine how that would happen today. You know, that's enough to get a war going. And so they go down there and invade the South. You know, for many people, you know, ultimately having horrible consequences of you know, furthering the centralization of U.S. government. But at the time, you know, the South had created a scenario that was going to be the only way that they were going to end slavery. So it was one of these great tragedies in American history. But ultimately, in the end, that here Lincoln was saying, like, there's no way that we're going to be able to stop the spread of slavery, and less than 10 years later, you have ended slavery. And so there's a lot of things like that in history, or in my lifetime, when I in the 1980s, the idea that the Soviet Union was going to disappear, you'd seem like, well, somebody's psychotic to be saying something like that, and poof, you know, these guys get in their own stupid wars, you know, in Afghanistan, and, you know, half that country sort of rebels by being drunk, you know, all the time, and the whole place is falling apart, and poof, there's no more Soviet Union, you know, and that would have been shocking if you were an American in the early 80s to think that way. So, you know, and there's a lot of different reasons for all of these things happening, but one of them was that people didn't give up completely, like people in Lufthansa and in Solidarity. You know, these guys were thinking, like, you know, they didn't think that the Soviet Union were as powerful as Americans did here, and so they just hung in there, and they tweaked the Soviet Union, and that along, like I say, with their Afghanistan war and a bunch of other things, that whole totalitarian, authoritarian structure fell apart. So I think the lesson for me to learn, and this is what, if you take a look at history, that anti-authoritarians, while they're right a lot of ways in their critical thinking, that sometimes not to get too arrogant, because a lot of these totalitarian societies and institutions are a lot more fragile than they really appear, and that's why it makes sense to sort of hang in there, if not your generation, your kids' generation, or somewhere down the road, for people to kind of keep these things alive, keep the spirit of resistance and truths alive, because you just never know when there's opportunities.
Absolutely right. And that's precisely the point of why it's so important to understand history, because I think people who understand and research and study history know that time after time after time, tyrannies always fall in the end. And it's important to understand that no matter what the darkness of the times we might be living through at the moment, they will pass, and there will be something else on the other side. So it's a question of building up that what we want to see on the other side.
But, right. They're either going to... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, please. Please go.
You know, they're going to either fall. They're ultimately, like you said, they're going to fall under either A, the weight of their own stupidity, or they're going to fall because they've been pushed a little to fall, or it's going to be a combination of both. And that's what mostly happens. And that when these things start to fall under the weight of their stupidity, and people out there are like out there who still have some strength, maybe they're even just a small minority of folks. And even in the American Revolution, it was not the majority of folks out there who were helping King George fall under the weight of his own stupidity and the British Parliament fall. You had a significant minority who helped push them. And between those forces of totalitarian stupidity and people out there with still some courage, and you saw the same thing, like I said, with the Soviet Union, then it'll happen a lot quicker than just simply waiting around for something to completely fall under the weight of its stupidity without any kind of help from anybody else.
Well, then let's transition into something more of a meta-level discussion, because I understand a lot of the things that you've written and talked about in the past, and correct me if this is a mischaracterization, but is about the idea of getting anti-authoritarians and others who have been pathologized by the psychological system to understand that in fact what they're doing is a healthy critique of the society, or can be at any rate, and that we need to come together and transcend political partisanship or whatever in order to confront the corporatocracy. And I understand, and I'm very much on board with that, but there's a sense to which it may be almost impossible to imagine an anti-authoritarian political movement per se, not only because these people are anti-authoritarian in nature and thus less inclined to follow a leader, so to speak, and the organization that's required for a political movement, but also because it strikes me that if anti-authoritarians are fundamentally nervous or critical of the centralization of power and control that always comes with that nexus of corporations and government, then what is the sense of coming together as a political movement in order to confront that? Wouldn't it be a more effective critique for individuals to sort of disengage from that system and to assert their own individuality rather than to come together under some broad political banner?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of great points in all that. Let me try to tackle a couple there. One is that when I talk about and get up stand up, that there's one political reaction is of people withdrawing individually or groups wherever they possibly can from whatever you want to call it, the corporatocracy, the machine, and wherever possible, you know, I'm all for that. If you can kind of disengage out there, create your own economic livelihood away from this kind of corporate state, and if you can pull that off, that's not only great for your own self-respect, but that's a beacon, that's a model for other people as well. So that's one thing. But I think the reality is that this, you know, corporate state, this corporatocracy, and so many other areas that you can't pull it off. Like they could come in there and through eminent domain or whatever, you could create this great farm or whatever you've done, and they can just come in there and just take it over and do whatever the heck they want. So there is a reason for people to also still act as a group politically. And so it gets back to the earlier part of your question is it possible for anti-authoritarians to actually get together? I think the part that I really wanted to make clear, and this is, I had a lot of folks who commented on that alternate article who appreciated me making this clear, even guys, people who had been in the military, folks who told me that, you know, most of the guys who were running the show there in the military were complete idiots, and they rejected that, their authority. But there are some folks, they felt, who they had respect for their authority. And I think the important ingredient here is not a complete dismissal of authority. So, for example, I have a car mechanic who I respect his authority. This guy knows what the heck he's talking about. Every time I've taken my car to this guy for the last 15 years, he's never cheated me. He always gets what's going on. He is a legitimate authority. I mean, I do know legitimate authorities in my life, and you're foolish to not respect what they know what they're talking about, because there's no way any one of us can really, you know, be on top of everything in life, especially modern technology. But whether it's technology or certain things interpersonally, you know, so there are certain people out there who are actual legitimate authorities who might help you with your family. There may be a couple of psychologists out there who actually might be able to give you some advice about how to work with your kid better, but there are many illegitimate authorities. So a huge part of being a healthy anti-authoritarian is to not dismiss all authorities, but to kind of like use your brain to assess whether this authority is legitimate or not. And once you have that kind of mentality, you know, you can organize a culture, organize a society that is very anti-authoritarian. So if you take a look, for example, at a lot of indigenous cultures, if you take a look at Native American history, you know, what was constantly going on was that there were authorities. There were the warrior authorities, there were the hunter authorities, there were different kinds of authorities. Many of these tribes had multiple kind of chiefs, and the folks who knew what they were doing, who were getting things done, who was working out, the people, you know, gave them that authority. The ones who were failures, who were leading them into traps, for example, you know, weren't helping them getting away from their enemy, they got fired by their people. They were deemed illegitimate authorities. And so I think in any kind of a healthy culture and a healthy kind of society, there's going to be folks who in certain areas of life, they're not going to be authorities in every one of the areas. There are going to be people, if you take a look, people all have natural talents, there can be multiple different authorities that you're going to look to at different parts of your life. Of course, it'd be nice to be as self-reliant as you possibly can, to know as much as you possibly can, but even folks I've known who are, you know, the most brilliant self-reliant people, they've gotten that way because they've respected certain authorities, certain books they've read, or certain ones of their teachers. So I think part of the thing that you want to be able to do is to have, again, confidence that you can create. There have been in 99% of the history of the world, you know, if you take a look at before the kind of state societies, that there were kind of more anti-authoritarian social organizations, and they still exist in certain spheres of life out there. So I think that's one thing.
It certainly is, and this is absolutely a fascinating conversation, but I see we could be talking about this for hours, and I don't want to monopolize your time so much, so I will leave things there for now on the condition that you will come back on the program in the future so we can continue this conversation someday.
This is great. I enjoyed it, James.
Excellent. Well, before we go, perhaps we should let people know about your website and also where they can purchase your books.
Sure. If they want to go to, there's a whole bunch of articles and some media, some video, and there's the books. You can buy them different ways. If you go to brucelevine.net, that's BRUCELEVINE.net, brucelevine.net, and people can just go there and, like I say, read a whole bunch of articles for free, or if they want to pick up some of these books we're talking about, there's different ways they could go to the publisher, the different kind of other internet ways of getting books. They're all through the website, brucelevine.net.
That's right, and there are links there: Amazon, Chelsea Green, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and the books again: Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populace, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy, Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks Corporations in a World Gone Crazy. Just tons of valuable material there, so I hope people will go to brucelevine.net. And Dr. Levine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.